is the Preparedness Radio Network, preparing you for natural and man-made disasters, helpful tips on gardening and homesteading. Be prepared and remember, preparedness saves lives. This is the Preparedness Radio Network.
If everything you eat comes out of boxes stored in your freezer, you might need the Self-Reliance Expo. If you're afraid to take out your own garbage because the neighbor kids might beat you up, you might need the Self-Reliance Expo.
Over 50 free training classes are coming to the Self-Reliance Expo at the Mesa Convention Center Friday, October 26th and Saturday, October 27th. Gardening, alternative home building, off-grid living, food preservation, cooking with the sun, self-defense classes, canine demos, and more.
If you can kill a houseplant just by looking at it, you might need the Self-Reliance Expo.
This event is fun for the whole family and is the largest of its kind in the nation. Learn how to do it yourself. Learn how to defend yourself. Save money, save a life.
If the only screwdriver you own is made of orange juice and vodka, you might need the Self-Reliance Expo.
It's the Self-Reliance Expo at the Mesa Convention Center, Friday, October 26th and Saturday, October 27th. Go to selfrelianceexpo.com for information and tickets.
We all know that Berkey Water Purification Systems are the most trusted name in water filtration. As an authorized Berkey dealer for over 6 years and serving thousands of satisfied customers, the Berkey Guy offers amazing specials for Berkey Water Filtration Systems. The Berkey Light Systems include a set of self-sterilizing and recleanable black purification elements that purify water by removing chlorine, pathogenic bacteria, cysts, and parasites to non-detectable levels and remove harmful chemicals such as herbicides and pesticides. Order the Berkey Light System today, complete with two black Berkey elements for only $231, and the Berkey Guy will ship your order free of charge. With the purchase of a Berkey Light, the Berkey Guy is also offering a set of fluoride and arsenic filters for only $39.99. That's over 30% off the retail price. Call the Berkey Guy at 1-877-886-3653. That's 1-877-886-3653. Or order online at GoBerkey.com. That's GoBerkey.com today.
Yeah?
Did you want to see me, sir?
Well, I did, but now that I do, I'm not so sure.
Sir?
Johnson, I got a mission for you that could change your life.
Oh, good, sir.
It involves traveling halfway around the world without so much as half a clue of where you're going or what you're going to do when you get there.
Situation normal, sir?
Uh-huh. Well, I'll be leading this mission, Johnson, so I'll be telling you what to do.
You, sir?
That's right, Johnson, and I say first things first.
Oh, good plan, sir.
And what I say is first is food. Always remember that, Johnson. Food is a big deal.
Sir, my brother-in-law can get us a really good deal on some surplus MREs.
Johnson, if you've got half a brain and that empty head of yours, you'll call the freeze-dry guy like I did. That food is better for you, rehydrates faster, and it's good, Johnson. And it keeps for up to 30 years.
Will we be gone that long, sir?
I hope not.
Now, get your supplies organized and meet me down to the pier at dawn on Sunday. We sail at sunrise.
Yes, sir.
This adventure is brought to you by the freeze-dry guy. Call 866-404-3663 or visit freezedryguy.com.
BHM Radio is on the air on the Preparedness Radio Network. BHM Radio is the official show for Backwoods Home Magazine, expanding the stories you love in print live across the net. And now, your hosts for BHM Radio, Colorado Ron and Bubba Da Vinci.
Hey, hey, hey. Welcome to Backwoods Home, Self-Reliance Exposed with Colorado Ron and Bubba Da Vinci. We're here every week with you on Saturday from 10 a.m. to noon Central Time. Are you out there, Colorado?
I'm here. How you doing, buddy?
Pretty good, pretty good.
What? That doesn't sound...
Dude, I am so tired. I mean, we didn't talk about it last week, but, you know, anybody that checks out our Facebook and everything knows that, you know, I ended up finding out that I have diabetes.
Yep.
And it really sucks because a year ago, I'd done a physical. I have to do it every year for my insurance, and I had my blood pressure was fine, my blood sugar was fine, my cholesterol was fine, and when I was in the show in North Carolina in Hickory, I was talking to Doc Bones and Nurse Amy because I was incredibly thirsty. I mean, I could not stop getting enough to drink, and as part of that, unfortunately, and this is a horrible thing to say on the radio, I mean, I couldn't stop going to the bathroom. I peed like crazy. It was like, because I was drinking so much, every couple of minutes it seemed like I had to run to the bathroom. I felt like I had a woman's bladder. And,
oh, no.
And they had said that that was a symptom of diabetes. And I said, oh, well, you know, I had that checked out and everything else. So anyway, in between the stops when I was doing my international tour, I went in and got checked out. And I was at 398, my blood sugar.
Oh, dang.
Yeah. I mean, the lady there said that she was surprised I was even functioning. Because, like, if above 400 impairs mental capability. And so
they
have this blood test that they can check and go back like 3 months and see what your blood sugar is, and then 6 months, which I think is just awesome. Anyway, so they were able to tap it, check it out, and saw that for the last 3 months, my blood sugar had been out of control. So according to them, not only did I have to take pills to get it under control, but I instantly had to go to insulin. And, you know, it's... I had decided that I'm going to drop some weight. I'm going to change my entire diet and my lifestyle and everything else to try to get this under control. And I've done. It's been fantastic. We've gotten it way, way down. But let me tell you, living the lifestyle that you and I live, where it's go, 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 and having to try to manage something like that too, where it's like, you know, your little buzzer goes off and it's like, oops, time to take a pill. Oops, you got to eat. Oops, you got to do this. Yeah. Man, it is a bear.
Anyway, yeah, heck with that. Jeez.
I know. Yeah, it's either that or keel over dead. So I guess guess I'm going to be, I'll be living by the clock for a while. So that's just it. It just seems like, you know, I had to go to the doctor for an MRI today and then run back for this. And it's like my meter's telling me, ooh, I was supposed to eat 2 hours ago. And I'm just like, egads, you know, just, I don't know. I'm not built to work to that kind of schedule.
It's tough. It really is. You know, there was a time, I didn't tell you this one time, but I was actually fasting. And I was on day 3 or 4. And I like to do a 5-day cleanse. And I think I was on day 3 actually, and we flew down to Dallas. That was in the middle of our Dallas meeting, and we flew down there. And you picked me up at the airport, and you had that big double chocolate chip frappuccino for me.
Oh, yeah.
And so I downed that after 3 days of not eating anything, and I was sick as a dog.
Yeah, let me tell you, it'll get you. I mean, I've cut out, I've kind of gone, you know, for diabetics, the two things, sugar and carbs.
Yep.
So you got to get rid of a bunch of pastas and, you know, and all this other stuff. And let me tell you, it's kind of like doing an Atkins diet or the paleo diet. And when you take a break and go, oh, I'll just have a piece of bread or whatever, your whole body goes into out of whack for, you
yep.
know, right when you do that, because it kind of gets trained not to process that stuff.
Right.
And yeah, let me tell you, it'll definitely play havoc with your system. I totally get you. So.
Yeah. You know, it was interesting is the, you know, I've been doing the, a loose version of the paleo diet for a while. And, I tell you what, eating carbs, I just don't like it. It makes me sick. I don't like it at all. You know, once your body gets used to it, it takes a little bit. Once your body gets used to it, though, you start eating something else, and it'll throw you way out of whack.
Yeah, I get that. Now, the interesting thing is if you can, you know, play with things a little bit, you can actually eat pretty healthy. I mean, I can eat meats and cheeses, which, you know, I love. I love both. And, you know, one of the things that, you know, and you can make stews and you can do all kinds of things. It's just a lot more work than most people. Everybody makes it so fast to run down and grab a burger or, you know, eat unhealthy that it seems like eating healthy is just a chore.
Right.
You know, but, yeah, it's what you got to do. And, yeah, that's I guess that's going to be my focus for a little bit, at least until I get this under control.
Yeah, no, I understand completely. I'm glad that you're taking those steps, though, to remove yourself from insulin if at all possible. I've met several people that have done that, and actually reversed it by eating, you know, strictly just vegetables and no fruits, you know, just vegetables and meat pretty much.
Yeah, and I think I'll be able to do it. And you know, some of the things that I'm doing is, you know, like I said, trying to find recipes and meals that don't make me feel like I'm being robbed of something.
Right. Oh, and it's so good, actually. You know what I just had last night? I'll tell you what I had last night. You guys are going to love it. And it's perfect for a paleo diet. I took a little bell pepper, you know, those little peppers. I don't know. I don't think they're called bell peppers, but they're about the size of a baseball.
That's a bell pepper.
A little bit smaller than a baseball, I guess. Maybe I don't know. Anyway, they're like a miniature version of a bell pepper. But what I did is we took chicken, a little bit of spinach, and stuffed it with a little bit of cream cheese in the bell pepper, and then I wrapped a piece of bacon around it and baked it in the oven. Oh, that's to die for.
Yeah, baked bell peppers. Yeah, we've done that. I've done that a couple times. I actually just like those in general. And that's a classic example, though, which is there are meals out there that, you know, just take a little more preparation. I usually dice up steak, brown it real quick first, and then mix a little ricotta and shredded cheese and mushrooms and stuff it with that. And then you'll let it all get gooey and melt inside there. And usually in about 20 minutes when the bell peppers, it stays kind of crispy and all the meat and everything's real soft inside. Now I'm getting hungry.
Now I'm hungry, yep. Cut.
Yeah, oh well. That's the way it works. I did have an interesting meal this week. My wife made me bear stew. Because I brought a bunch of bear meat back and we wanted to give it a try. And bear meat is very, well, it's kind of funny. Everybody I've talked to when I said I was going bear hunting told me that, bear meat tastes nasty, and B, that it's really fatty. And when I was up in Canada, I was talking to the guide service, and he laughed, and he goes, you know, it's the exact opposite. And he goes, most people that have eaten bear have eaten what he calls junkyard bear. And he said that these are bears that are nuisance bears that they get the ability to hunt in on the East Coast or up in Alaska. And these bears live probably a majority of their life eating out of dumps and people's trash cans.
Oh, no.
And he goes, and of course that's going to take nasty. He goes, have you ever caught, you know, shot a coon that that lives in the city? He goes, it's just gnarly with fat. And he goes, but if you eat a bear that's like from northern Alaska where there's no garbage and things like that, or up in Canada where their diets consist of meat and berries and fish, he goes, they're incredibly lean. There's a lot of fat built up on the outside. You got to shave it all out. But he goes, the meat is very lean and it's very, very tasty. So I brought a bunch of the meat back and I diced it up and we cooked it. I browned it and then we put it in the stew, and we cooked it a second time in the stew. And let me tell you, super tender, super lean, and it was delicious. You would think that you were, you know, eating a piece of, like, flank steak or something. It was just really, really good.
Oh, nice, nice.
Yeah, really dark meat, though. I mean, it's really, really dark, like a buffalo or an elk.
Huh, interesting.
Yeah, but it was very yummy. Carrots and onions and it was a wonderful stew, and so I think I've now tasted bear meat, and I've got another 20 pounds in the freezer. So
sweet.
I will, and just so you know, I am bringing a small bear roast to you, out at the show next week.
So
make sure you have a cooler.
All right.
You're gonna have to keep it frozen. What I'm gonna do is I'm gonna have it frozen, and then every night pack it nice to get it down to you, and you should be able to get it back without any problem.
Okay. All right. I'll bring it.
But, yeah, cook it up like a regular roast and fantastic. Just really, really yummy.
Oh, maybe I'll cook it, slow cook it all day in a sun oven or something.
Yeah, or you know, or what I'm going to try is, and I'm probably going to do it this weekend, Backwoods Home Magazine, our current issue, 138, which is be on the shelves this week, the November-December issue for 2012, our last issue for the year.
I got it.
Oh, you finally got it. Good. And I was going to rub it in a little bit, but I decided. Has a recipe in there on page 22 for chili.
Oh, and, bear chili.
Yeah, and it's and you look at this recipe, and it calls for, I think, 4 pounds of lean diced meat.
Oh, perfect.
And,
perfect.
Yeah, and I thought, you know, this the bear meat is so flavorful, and it talks about browning the chunks, and it follows almost the same process. I was like, you know, this would probably make an excellent chili. So you might want to take a look at that recipe and maybe go home and make the kids and the family some bear chili.
Yes, definitely. I'm on it. I'll be all over that. That sounds amazing.
Yeah, and you can post it up on Facebook so people can see your bear chili.
Yep. I'll do it. I'll do it right after the expo, guys. You heard it here. I'm going to be making some bear chili.
Yeah, all right. So y'all getting set? Yes, you know, I'm freaked out. I mean, we leave in like 4 days.
Yeah.
I leave Monday morning for a 27-hour drive. Holy crap.
Which route are you going? Are you coming through here?
You know, I haven't decided yet. I was going to talk to you about it over the weekend. I'm seriously, but I don't know when you're leaving. I was seriously thinking about coming across and going through your neck of the woods, just because it's a little hilly for pulling a trailer, but it's also the least boring of the ways to go. Because the other way would be for me to go into Kansas and everything else, and then cut all the way across those plains, kind of diagonal, and go through New Mexico and into Arizona, and that's just one long boring
drive.
Yeah. instead of going through those beautiful hills, I mean, because you'd go down into New Mexico, the corner of New Mexico, down by Arizona, but you're going through the hills.
Yeah.
I think it'd probably be a nicer drive. I just got to figure it out. Either way, it comes out about 27 hours.
Oh yeah, man, that's a long trip for you.
Yeah, it's gonna be a long one.
It's 600 miles from here. I mapped it, so it's only 12 hours for me.
That's it, really?
Yeah, that's what it said.
That doesn't. How many hours for you?
It said, well, I always just double it. So if it's 600 miles, that'd be 12 hours at 55 mile an hour.
Okay, so well, if it's 12 for you and I'm 10 from you. So that's about 22.
Yeah,
so that sounds about right.
You should just plan on coming here and staying the night here. And
well,
then
when are you all leaving?
I was going to leave either Tuesday or Wednesday morning.
Oh, then, yeah, that might work. I mean, I figure I don't want to push it. You know, just take it slow. And I was thinking about leaving like Monday afternoon, getting halfway down. You know, and that would be 10 hours. That would be good. And then from there, just jumping in the next day. That way I have plenty of time. We have Wednesday to kind of, you know, plus – who knows what happens between the trips. So
right.
But I'll take a look at it, and we can make the decision. But I mean, y'all set? Who's all going down with you?
Same as last time. It'd be me, my father, and my two older sons.
Good. Well, that's pretty cool. I'm actually pretty excited to get this going. Their weather's been great. It's already getting cold here. And so I'm kind of looking forward to going down and getting a little warmth going before winter really hits in.
Oh man, I tell you, it's gonna be a bad winter. I think. What do you think?
Oh yeah, I think it's gonna pound us. I don't think that there's any way that we're not gonna get completely pounded this year. It's just the way it's gonna be, brother. Just the way it's gonna be.
Bring it.
Yep.
That's the way I say. Bring it. Let's just get it on. Get it over with.
Well, before we jump into your finding of properties, your
homestead hunter,
we should talk about who our guest is. So our guest today is Sylvia Gist, And Sylvia is a contributing editor for, contributing writer for Backwoods Home Magazine. In last month's issue, she had an article called "The Potato Hole" in the magazine, and she's had multiple articles. She does a lot of cold storage and making nut butter and just kind of general storage and canning articles for us. And she also writes for the Back Porch View. And so we're going to get her on here and talk to her a little bit about how she got into homesteading and that type of thing, but also cold storage, you know, getting ready for winter. You know, this is something I'm horrible at, and I have, you know, everybody talks about it, and, you know, my grandparents did it, and up here in Iowa, everybody has a, like a cellar, like a root cellar.
Root cellar, okay.
They call them caves. And these are buildings that aren't attached to your property. They're out somewhere on the property, and they have a door, and you go down into them. There's steps going down, and it's just a big earthen hole. And that's where they store their goods, including their canning stuff. They're usually 8 to 10 feet down, and it's below the frost line, and it just stays cool there year round. And I haven't even figured out what you'd put in there. I mean, to me, it just seems bizarre putting things down there in the hole, like onions and potatoes, and actually think that they'd last the entire summer and the entire winter. Because I'm a new prepper. And I'm kind of one of these new age preppers. I grew up with Walmarts and stuff. And you know, if something sits on the shelf for more than 5 days, they're throwing it in the garbage. You know, so the idea of eating an apple or eating fruits and vegetables that have been down in a hole for 6 months, you know, kind of freaks me out a bit. So, not afraid to say it. You heard it here first.
crazy man. No, those are cool. I really like them. I personally have never had that experience, so I'm looking forward to talking with her about that. I'm going to pick her brain on that one for sure.
Yeah. All right, so let's do Homestead Hunter. What do you got for us today?
All right, so this week's Homestead Hunter is, this is what I did. I thought, well, since we're going down to Arizona anyway, why not look for a piece of property down in Arizona? Again, just so everybody knows, Homestead Hunter is a series that we're doing, and the home has to be at least 3-bedroom, 1-bath, on a minimum of 5 acres of land, and has to be under $150,000. So yep. Those are our parameters. I found this one, and I'm posting it on my Facebook page right now. You can go to facebook.com/ColoradoRonPage, and this one is in... was Ash Fork, Arizona, which is just outside of Flagstaff. They have a little airport there, and then of course you can get to Phoenix and fly anywhere you need to. So this one is, it looks like a log home. It's on 5 heavily treed acres. It says 2 stories with 2 bedrooms up and a 2 bedrooms down and a den, and then 1 bedroom up. And then it's got... it's got a little loft upstairs and seating room. I don't know. It's a pretty nice little house. It's about 1,400 square foot, it says. So what do you think?
Just for my opinion, it's a modern log home. So it looks like it has all the amenities, forced air.
Yep.
It's definitely not off-grid.
No. Nope.
I mean, well, 5 acres, in Flagstaff is about as off grid as you're going to get out there. I mean, it's it looks like it's in a massive like park community where people bought 5 and 10 acre pieces of property and had like little farmsteads.
Yep.
And the nice thing is I mean, if from the pictures here, it does, the tree line and everything looks really, really nice. And it's close enough that if you're trying to, you still have to work and fly around and do things, you're not that far from things. So, I mean, it's actually a pretty nice piece of property. And the price is nice. They just dropped it from $133 to $125.
Yep. Yeah, I don't know. I thought it was kind of cool. It you know, it definitely had the design, you know, the architecture of a something you would think of as a homestead hunter or home, you know, a homestead property. So I thought it was kind of cool.
Yeah, I would say that this is probably more in line with the person who's trying to get out to the big city but doesn't want to go out into, you know, middle of nowhere.
Yep.
And
that's me.
Yeah, and yeah, exactly. Because it looks like, you know, looking at this, and just I just pulled up the zip code. It's internet friendly, so you can get internet in the area, and you can't get cable, unfortunately. But satellite, you would be able to do satellite. So someone again that you don't want to be a complete suburbanite, but you want to get someplace that's away from everybody. They look like they have a nice little garden started in the front. Yeah, I'd say it's a good middle option for a suburban prepper looking to kind of get out but not get way out.
Yep, exactly.
Yeah, so I'd scoop this one up. It's only been on the market for 3 months, which isn't very long for a lot of these properties. Although they look like they want to sell because they already dropped it. They already dropped the price, and the house was built in 2004. So
yes, it's really new.
Mm-hmm. It is a really new piece of property. Wow, and taxes are dirt cheap.
Isn't that ridiculous? I saw that. I was like, what? No way.
Yeah, so, wow. Yeah, so I think that this is a good choice. And again, I'm not a big Arizona fan.
Right. Me, yeah. Sorry, guys. Me neither.
and I like Flagstaff. I used to go up to the Flagstaff area and go skiing and everything else. And it's still too dry, even with trees and everything else, and it's got some beautiful pine trees up there, and it gets snow. When it's not snowing, it is just dirt and clay with a bunch of trees growing out of it. It's just not my kind of woods would like to live.
In all fairness, I can see why Flagstaff was settled. I mean, picture yourself back in the day on your way to California through Texas on horseback. And you run across Flagstaff with all the trees and the rivers and little snow cap here and there. I guarantee you, I would it would have been really hard for me to get back on that horse and keep going through the desert out to California. I think I might have stopped myself.
No, and I think you're right. I think that Flagstaff, the primary reason is going west of the Pecos and going through New Mexico and Arizona towards California was a hell of a daunting task because it's all desert.
Yeah.
And, you know, this is above that. And then if you go north of here and you're hitting more desert, right? Because that's going to be just north of this is going to be you're going to be going into Utah and Nevada.
Yep.
And that's just nuts. And well, I mean,
it is.
It's people don't realize how bad the area around there is. I mean, if you've never been around the Grand Canyon, I mean, or any of that area, when you go, you know, Flagstaff is, you go straight up 17 and you're in the like the Grand Staircase National Monument area, which is really, really beautiful. But if you go directly east or west of that, it's desert. Both up in Utah and back. And if you go just 3 hours west of it, you're in like Las Vegas, which if anybody's ever been to Las Vegas, is a big fire pit. There ain't nothing out there. I mean, you're just keep going and you're in Death Valley. I mean, it's just horrible.
Yep.
So, I mean, I guess, I can totally see why it was settled to, and it is beautiful. Grand Canyon National Park is just north of that area, too. So I have to imagine there's lots to do and lots to see. So,
awesome. Yep, I agree.
All right. So I guess we should get ready to call Sylvia. There seemed like there was something else important that I wanted to make sure I covered. But it's just totally not hitting me. Oh, how's Heather feeling? That's what it was.
Yeah, she's still feeling pregnant.
There you go. That's what happens.
Yeah, she's doing well. So, I mean, she still does her morning exercises and stuff and goes for walks with her friends and still does that and is doing well. Today she said she was about ready to call and say she wasn't going today, but she did it anyway. So she's a real trooper. She keeps on going and homeschooling the kids and cooking the meal. So, you know, obviously everybody pitches in a little bit more and helps her out so she can take a little bit longer naps. But, everything's going good.
God bless her. I mean, I was talking about her the other day, and I was like, she timed it right because canning season is basically over. And I would have just felt, she's going into basically the slow season. I mean, Christmas, winter, and season. Everything else, so she can kick up her feet a little bit and get a little bit more rest. Because Lord knows when the kids are out of school and there's all kinds of play dates and things going on and, you know, a zillion things going on and getting the backyard ready and gardening and everything else. There's no rest for the weary.
That's it. No, it's pretty crazy. We just got everything done. I mean, I've been working like nonstop between the expo and honeydews around the house, trying to get everything ready for winter. Just been working nonstop, got all the wood chopped and getting all that stuff ready. And she's been in there canning, and we've been cleaning out the garden and, you know, just doing all this stuff, trying to get everything prepared for winter. But, you know, I tell you what, this winter I'm taking some time off because I got nothing to do. I've got everything done and I'll be ready to go.
Well, so. And you're actually kind of lucky because I told you that I would take the first couple of, you know, I'm doing most of the event stuff early this year. And so hopefully you'll actually get a chance to relax because we'll have everything done before December for the first couple of events next year.
That would be nice.
Yeah. Yeah, we're actually, as soon as we get back from this event, we're going to start selling for the Arlington, Texas event next year. And hopefully we'll get the Mother Earth News stuff up and announced and everything else and get those going. And it'll be nice to be way ahead of the curve for next year.
Yes. No, I agree. I agree 100%. We've already got several vendors that have been sending me emails asking me, what our dates for next year are so that they can get them on the calendar. So pretty excited about that.
Yeah, my whole thing is we got to wait till the election. I'm not announcing anything until I see which way the wind's blowing.
That's a good point.
Yeah, I mean, who knows which way this is going to go? Our business is either going to be booming or our business is going to be, but that's okay. Either way, we'll make it work. All right, well, let's go ahead and give Sylvia a call and get her on here. I told you guys last time, you know, for the next couple of weeks, we are going to be, and we actually, we're kind of enjoying this, so we may be pre-taping most of our shows, I think, going forward. But so since we are pre-taping our shows, we basically are calling people directly. It's kind of fun. Get to listen to the buzz. Oh, there it goes.
Hello?
Hi, Sylvia?
Yes.
Hi, this is Bubba Da Vinci. I'm here with Colorado Ron. We're calling you from Backwoods Home Magazine, Self-Reliance Exposed.
Oh, hi.
How you doing today?
Good.
All right.
Very good.
Well, we're glad we caught you, and thank you for coming on the show.
You're welcome.
So a little bit about you and kind of getting some background on you. Now, you're a retired teacher that contributes articles for both Backwoods Home Magazine and Back Porch View. Is that correct?
Right.
Now, I have to ask, how did a retired school teacher get involved in prepping and writing prepping stories?
Well, I guess it has to do with the fact that I was an English teacher, and so I was a writer and taught writing, and also that I grew up learning how to do everything for myself, basically, and I looked around and saw that people nowadays don't seem to they don't know how to do all that kind of stuff because so much stuff is done for them. And I just felt like that I could pass on some information to those who are learning how to do it and didn't have that chance when they were young like I did.
Now, what kind of environment did you grow up on? I mean, you're saying that you grew up with it. I mean, were did you grow up in the city, or was it a rural lifestyle?
No, I was 15 miles from a very small town in South Dakota, and on the prairie. We didn't have electricity or running water or whatever. We had wood heat and carried the water from the well, and just lived pretty much like my folks had lived, you know, previous to that. And by the time I was a teenager, then electricity came, and you know, those things changed. But I had also learned by that time how you can live without it.
And have you lived this lifestyle pretty much from then on? I mean, you kind of grew up with it, but when you became a teacher and you kind of went off on your own, did you continue to still prep, or was it something you ended up having to come back to?
You know, kind of in and out. I think there were times when I, you know, if I had the facilities, I grew a garden. I'd like to can food whenever I was or could. In some years, we didn't. I married a guy who didn't mind hunting, and so when we were in places where you could hunt, we had antelope and deer and reindeer and, you know, wild meat to eat. And in Alaska, we fished a lot, so we were kind of living a subsistence lifestyle in addition to doing our own work. So I kind of bought into that I can do it myself. I can try to provide some of my own food, independent sort of thing.
Very cool.
You know, for my entire whole life.
Now, I have to ask.
I don't know if I answered your question or not.
No, that's okay. I have to ask you, where did you get reindeer?
We were living on the Pribilof Islands out in the Bering Sea. That's about 800 miles due west of Anchorage. 35 square miles surrounded by water. And back in the maybe 40s or something, the U.S. government had imported reindeer as a food source for the Aleut people who lived there, because they had been brought there by the Russians back when the Russians were in the fur business. And the Americans took that same business over, and so it was supposed to be a food source for them, and so there was a herd of reindeer on the island. And it wasn't the favorite food source for them because they were basically fish eaters and seal eaters, and they allowed us to hunt reindeer, so we ate reindeer. It's like venison.
Wow. Yeah, that's pretty cool. We did I was able to eat reindeer while I was in Alaska as well, and then also in Iceland. They have it in Iceland. And both places, you know, we were able to grab a bite of reindeer, so that was awesome. How long did you live in Alaska?
For 8 winters, not necessarily consecutively. I say winters because that's kind of how we can count them, but over a span of, I don't know, 10, 12 years, I guess. So in different areas. We lived out there on the island for 5 years, and we ate halibut because that was the main the fish that was available around there, and crab.
Oh, yeah.
Can't afford to eat it now, but we didn't eat it on everything at the time because that's what there was. And then we spent some time on the Yukon River area with in Eskimo villages.
Eskimo on the Yukon River, yeah, that's interesting. We did. I rode along the Yukon up to. I rode a motorcycle up to the Arctic Circle a couple of years ago, and that was very unique. We met a lot of interesting people and saw a lot of interesting things along that route. Some really tough people up there, that's for sure.
Yeah, well, that's one area that we actually didn't get into. We spent most of our time close to the Delta, closer to the, you know, western end of it.
Uh-huh.
So it was and it's salmon. Well, there's salmon all along the, in all the rivers, I guess, pretty much, too. So we ate a lot of salmon when we were out that way. So.
Nice. Now, I had a quick question for you as far as the article that you had written in last month's Backless Home Magazine. It's on page 12. It's called, you titled it The Potato Hole.
Uh-huh.
Now, that's very interesting. The title caught my attention. So, could you explain a little bit about that?
It came about by accident. We dug up a tree, and then we were about, well, I don't know. My husband kept digging and digging in these trees, and this chokecherry tree, which I had planted there because it would be a good source of juice for syrup and jelly, but it sort of got out of control, growing into the garden, sprouting up everywhere. So we decided to take it out and begin the process of digging, and it got to be a pretty good sized hole, and I suggested to my husband that if we dug it just a little bit bigger, we could drop a 2-foot, I think about, I'm not sure exactly, cement or concrete riser that we'd taken off of our septic system. It was starting to decay a little bit, and so we had taken it out, and it was just basically rolling around the property. And so we decided that, so we measured it and started hacking out the hole and got it the right size and put hardware cloth on the bottom because we've got a mole problem. And it managed to drop it in there, and he created a lid for it. And it's not really very big, but for the two of us, it stores quite enough carrots and potatoes, you know, for the season. And I'd say probably 100 pounds of potatoes we could probably put in there.
Oh, wow.
And whatever. And then we're on the west side of the Continental Divide, so we're not as cold as some areas. And so it doesn't usually freeze down too deep here. So I put a bag of straw over the top. We've got some insulation in the covering. And he's going to upgrade it and put this metal roofing on the top of it.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, to make it more weather-resistant, I guess.
Gotcha.
Because
do you worry about, like, rodents getting in there or anything like that in the winter?
Well, it's pretty tight.
Okay.
Because we've got the hardware cloth on the bottom, and then the top sets right down on the concrete. So I haven't
gotcha.
Had a problem. And we had, I'm kind of for overdoing things, and so I put bags of leaves over the top of it just to be sure. And I pulled those up, and there were vole tracks all around the edge there. And they had not gotten into the hole. So, you know, I figured must have been pretty decent. So
now, Sylvia, let me ask you, when you're talking, you said about 100 pounds of potatoes. Do you grow the potatoes and carrots yourself? And is there a difference when you're storing vegetables? Do fresh vegetables, things you grow in your garden, survive longer than things in the store? And you got to remember, I'm, you know, Colorado Ron's got a little more experience with some of this stuff than I do. I'm a complete noob on this stuff. I'm prepperly
okay.
challenged.
Alrighty. Well, then you have a lot of interesting things ahead of you to learn. I guess it isn't. I suppose it depends on where they're grown, but I find a few things that are very valuable in doing the storage. Okay, I don't dig my potatoes until the weather gets cool enough that I think it is also cool in the ground. So we dug them about a week ago. Some people are digging them in September, but, you know, we hold off as long as we can. That way they don't get the chance to warm up. And there are some varieties of potatoes that store better than others. There was some website I got a chart off of that, you know, that indicated whether they have good storage or not. So that makes a difference. Half a dozen at least different varieties in the hole. And I can tell, you know, towards spring, which ones are storing the best. Some of them have sprouts and some of them don't. And then when it comes to carrots, the variety is extremely important. I grow a storage variety for storing. And I start out with Bolero carrots, which is a hybrid, and they stored really, really well. But then I found an open pollinated variety that I can save the seed from, which is another thing that I try to do so that I'm more independent. And they store really well, too. It's called Rumba.
Rumba?
Rumba. Mm-hmm. It's an open pollinated variety. And they do. I have a friend that lives half a mile, I suppose, away, and she's just gotten into the gardening thing, and she tried those, and she said that's her favorite carrot. So, and she stores them, but she stores them in her carrots in a refrigerator, which works, actually, if you store the right variety.
Well, and I was going to say, it has to be a right variety thing, because, you know, I'll put carrots in the refrigerator, and, you know, 2 weeks later, they're all soft and limp and, you know, and they don't seem to hold very well. And,
right.
You know, I started doing some research when we found out we were going to be talking to you, because I know you like to write about storage in general, but a lot about cold storage. And I was finding people that would say that they could put apples and carrots and potatoes and store them for like 6 months and they would still be crunchy. And I'm just like, there's no way. I mean, I have a crisper, quote unquote, in my refrigerator, and, you know, believe me, the stuff doesn't come out crisp. So I guess, you know, well, that's what it says. It's got a little sign on it that says crisper.
That's true. And you're right. It can be kind of slushy.
It comes out like a limp noodle.
And I think it helps to dig the carrots. Like, I need to go out this afternoon and dig some more of my carrots because it's supposed to get cold and maybe snow by this time next week. After frost, always wait until after frost to dig the storage carrots, because they get sweeter after frost. They store whatever it takes to make them sweeter. And then the weather's cooler, and they don't have the chance to decide they want to grow again. I try to put them away when it's cool.
I didn't know that. So you're saying after a frost, they actually are sweeter?
They're supposed to be. I don't know that I've actually tested it, you know, but that's what they say. So I think the conditions that you grow them under probably does affect how well they store.
I have to imagine that. That makes sense. Now, what about, this is another totally amateur question, what about cross-storing? I mean, can you store, like, multiple things, like your potatoes and your carrots and apples and, you know, everything else in the same area? Or, you know, does each one of them have, like, a different temperature they should really be at to stay crispy? I mean, is it going, you know, is one going to affect another? Or is it okay to keep, you know, everything in there?
A good article that I wrote for Backwoods Home that's online has to do with cold storage instead of a few years ago. But there are some, you do have some problems. Apples generally shouldn't be stored with potatoes because apples give off a gas. And they can make them sprout. And the temperatures, it's not so much the temperatures, it's the humidity. A friend of mine was asking about potatoes and carrots. Well, checking it out, potatoes like 90% humidity, and pardon me, did I say carrots? I meant onions. Onions and potatoes. And onions, like about 60 to 70% humidity. More like what you use in your house, you know, rather than what's in the cellar. So I store my potatoes in the ground if I can, and my onions I store with my my food storage in my basement, which isn't that damp.
Well, that
like where
sense.
I would save my canned goods, you know. And I give you a variety of onion that stores really well.
Okay.
It's a hybrid. It's called copra, C-O-P-R-A, copra. And I took one of those onions out. I've still got three or four of them down there from last year. I haven't opened them up. But in July, I cut an onion, and it was perfectly good to use.
Wow.
So it stored that long. It's a really hard, nice-sized onion.
Is it
know?
A sweet onion, or is it more of the...
No. Your sweet onions, if they're actually sweet onions, they're not going to store. They don't have the ingredient. I'm not very good at chemistry. That you would, you know, that would make them store. That's why they're sweet. So it's a pungent, hard onion.
Okay, more like a yellow onion or like a North Star.
Yeah. Right. Yes. Right.
See, I know something about onions.
I think the North Star is listed as a keeper onion, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's about the only onion I know. So that was I just blew the whole wad there. That's it.
Well, I can't complain about the copras because they grow to, you know, not quite baseball size, and they the best keeper that I've had. Put it that way.
Well, that's good to know. It's actually a very good. It's a very good cooking. At least the North Star is a very good cooking onion.
Right. Right.
You know,
it holds up. Good.
Yeah, it really spices things up, and people like to dice it up and put it in stews and soups, mm-hmm. and very, very fragrant, too.
Right. Yeah, it would be similar to that.
Now,
might make you cry a little.
That's why you have your wife cut it up.
Ah.
That's I'm going to pay for that one. Okay.
Yeah.
So what about other types of things that you can store? I mean, if you don't mind giving us a rundown, I mean, can you store... you know, we've already had conversations with people storing eggs, you know, as far as that sort of thing is very easy. I know most of your articles, I think, have been about fruits and vegetables. I mean, do you do any cold storage with, like, meats and cheeses, or is everything that you pretty much cold store the fruits and vegetables?
Fruits and vegetables. The only meat that I actually raise is chicken, and we put that in the freezer. But... so many of these other things, the vegetables can actually be, you know, we store beets. That's cold storage. I'm thinking something else, like dried stuff, you know. We dry some things to store, ferment some things to store.
That was a good segue. Now, we were talking about this before. Cold storage is definitely one way you can store, but you said fermenting is another way. Now, when you said that, I wanted to say something to you earlier. In my head, fermenting is what my grandfather used to do, which when he fermented grapes to make, you know, vino,
right.
You know, local table wine. What kind of vegetables do you ferment? I mean, is fermenting the same thing as pickling?
No, actually, it doesn't. Fermenting doesn't have anything to do with vinegar. Vinegar is fermented. That's one of the things you can ferment. It's the list of fermented vegetables is, or items I should say, is extensive, all the way from yogurts. What is it that they do with soy and ferment it for some things? Maybe soy sauce even. You know, so they do it with that. They do it with milks. Cheeses are fermented. And then, of course, your wines. Sourdough bread is a form of fermentation. So I guess I could, when you're fermenting, you're using some microorganism like bacteria, yeast, mold, or even a combination of that, to change the chemistry of a product. So let's say, for example, the most common that and it goes back forever, back to the Chinese, is sauerkraut. And they fermented it, and then they were able to carry it with them, and it came into Europe, I guess, with the whoever, Mongols or something that, you know, might have come to Europe. And that, you take the cabbage and with salting, and it has this bacteria on it. And so when you get done, you have lowered the acidity to somewhere around 4, and that's what preserves it.
Huh.
Now, I have to say one thing real quick. I actually, mm-hmm. when you said the Mongols brought it in, I actually had fermented yak's milk one time when I was in China, right over by the border of Nepal, and it was like very interesting flavor. I mean, now that you said it, it was like, yeah, I remember it was like I had fermented cheese and I had fermented yak's milk and all kinds of fermented stuff over there. A lot of these people still live in yurts. And live a nomadic life, and they actually don't refrigerate things. And almost seemed like 50% of their stuff was fermented. And let me tell you, you never forget your first fermented yak's milk.
Did it taste yakky?
I would imagine that pretty much every culture has something fermented, you know, because they, you know, didn't have refrigeration and some of that stuff that goes way back. And
interesting.
You know, it's supposed to be healthy for you, you know, because it introduces a good bacteria into your digestive system. So, thus the reason for yogurt and all these things being called health foods.
Now I have a question for you as far as storage. Obviously, everybody's definition of storage is different, but with all the different root cellars and potato holes and things like this that you've ran across, have you ever is there a good recommendation, I guess, for somebody saying that, say they live in a neighborhood and they would like to store enough food for their family, what would be the best route to go as far as building a root cellar to help with that storage?
I suppose I really can't answer that question because I've never had a root cellar. And this here where we live now, since we've retired, is the only place I've ever actually had a room dedicated to food storage, which is like a corner of my basement that we insulated, and it stays at maybe 50 degrees, I guess. Which keeps things a lot better. And we do some other kinds of things, like we have stairway leading into the basement, and so at the bottom of that, it stays cooler but doesn't freeze as much. So we store some things there. And I would love to have a root cellar. I know where I could have put a root cellar pretty easy had I thought about it when I was building the house. I don't know. It's to do it economically, you know, it can be a problem to do have the perfect thing. So.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen all kinds of cool different ideas. You know, people burying trash cans all the way down to digging out and building a full walk-in room. There's all sorts of different neat ideas. When you store like the carrots and things like that, in the picture here, I see all the potatoes are touching each other, so I assume that's fine. When I was up in Blackfoot, Idaho, and they had those big potato storages, they just had a big room full of potatoes, so I assume that them touching is fine. But carrots, on the other hand, people separate. Is that right?
Yeah, when I put them in the sand, I do separate them. Put sand between all of them. But the potatoes need to have air around them, I guess. I'm not sure exactly where the what the reason for that is, but there's a number of things that they say that, you know, to store in like sawdust, damp sand, and it's things like carrots, parsnips, beets, radishes, the winter radishes. But other things they don't, like the, you know, apples, of course you don't. So I don't know exactly why that. Cabbages you wouldn't bury either. And you can store some cabbages too.
But some things you can't mix, like you were talking about. Do you know what some of the things that you shouldn't mix? Obviously you said apples. Is apples the only one?
That's the only one I can think of right off that... I don't know if it's because it's a fruit or what, but they seem to give off a certain kind of gas that makes things ripen, therefore, you know, like progress where they shouldn't, because you don't want them to go. You want them to stay. You want all this stuff to stay just like it was when you put it in there.
Right.
You know, so I guess I choose, you know, I store what I can that way. I can things. I dry stuff, freeze some things. So I use a big variety of methods to store the fruits and vegetables. So,
gotcha.
And, you know, try to cover all my bases, which is probably impossible.
Yeah, we do a lot of canning around here. My wife really enjoys doing that, and we just canned a bunch of meat over the weekend. One of the things that I really enjoy is when she does pickled carrots, and I just love those. And her pickles, of course, are always amazing. But I enjoy pickling things. I have never done the fermentation deal. Is that a pretty easy process?
You know it is. I thought it was going to be really, really difficult, and I got started when I inherited my grandmother's 5-gallon crock. And so I thought, I've got to try this, just because I need to try that. And had never eaten fresh sauerkraut before either. But so I tried that, and it was successful, and read a little bit more. There's a sauerkraut guru, no, I mean a fermentation guru, Sandor Katz. He's at wildfermentation.com. And I ran across it on the Internet, and it was... like super simple. You just shred up whatever vegetables you want and then mix it with some salt and make sure that everything is covered with liquid. If it doesn't juice itself, well, then you add a little bit of kind of salt stuff, salt water, and then let it sit at room temperature for a little while and watch it bubble and burp. And in a week or so, you've got fermented vegetables. And if you add garlic, it really stink. But yeah. I did red cabbage and carrots and onions, you know, together, and it makes a real spicy condiment. You know, like it's not like like vinegar has a real. It's different, you know, than the pickle. But it still has quite a lot of zip to it.
What was the name of that website?
Wildfermentation.com.
Wildfermentation.com. Okay. Mm-hmm. I'll have to look that up.
Yeah, he gives it. And then I got an article from somebody about fermentation. It was in some fancy cooking magazine. But the writer had.
When we were there a couple times, and I just never had the time, I guess, or never made the time, to learn it. So I think that that might be a pretty cool process to check out.
Well, if you think that, you know, you have to do a big batch of sauerkraut, that's one thing. But actually, you can just take a quart jar and, you know, shred up some veggies that you like. The cabbagey ones work pretty good, you know, like kohlrabi, any color cabbage, little onion, carrot, You might think of some others too, and you know, just put them in a quart jar and set them on your cupboard. So it doesn't have to be very much, you know, just to experiment.
Interesting. That's a good point. That's a really good point. I think I might try that, so that I know what I'm talking about when I go to the expo. Give it a try.
Check out the one thing to maybe to look up is to be how much salt you'd want to use.
Okay.
You know, what's the safest? You could oversalt it, and it can be yucky. If you undersalt it, then it can dissolve into slush because you want a nice, crisp whatever. But,
okay.
You know, yeah, a small experiment. It's worth it. You might find you want to do gobs of it.
Yeah, interesting. Interesting. Yeah, no, I agree. The now back to your potato hole. Again, how deep is that hole?
Excuse me?
How deep is the hole?
You know, my husband and I were discussing that the other day for sure. I don't know if it's got to be more than 2 feet. Maybe 30 inches.
And
it's
is that the
really
only
deep.
Kind of is that the only kind of device? That, I mean, the cold storage you have, or do you have other types also?
No, that's the only in-ground storage I have. I use. But to do the same thing, I do put some things in sand in coolers at the bottom of my steps in my garage,
okay.
And just make sure they don't freeze.
I was telling Colorado Ron right before you came on that this is something I really wanted to learn. Now you're up in Montana, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, my wife loves Montana. She went to school up there, and you know. If I had an excuse to go up there again, she'd just probably love it. But anyway, we moved from Texas to Iowa, and when we came up here, a lot of people up here have what they call caves, and you know, they seem to essentially be root cellars. You know, they're carved into the ground, and they have a part of it's above ground where you have a door so you can go down there. But people, it seems to be like multi-leveled, and you get to the first landing, and people have shelves where they put their canning down there. But it gets a little deeper, and then people store in baskets and stuff their cold storage items. And I'm assuming that's just because it's the deeper you go, the more constant the temperature is. I'm guessing, but that seems to be very popular up here is these caves.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. We had a cellar when I grew up, on the ranch and. And it was, we didn't like to go into it. It was kind of just a door, and you went down some steps, not fancy at all, just a hole in the ground. And then my dad piled the potatoes in one place, and he put he had some crocks with sand and carrots in another place. The whole thing was probably 8 by 8 at the most. And the top of it was simply, I don't know, it just looked like kind of like dirt. But occasionally we'd find a rattlesnake skin hanging from the rafters. And so we kids didn't really want to go down there. So mostly my dad went down there. But it wasn't a fancy one. You know, it wasn't a place where you could store jars or anything. It was definitely just a, something like the homesteaders would dig.
Right.
Old homesteaders. Like my grandmother actually homesteaded there, so.
That's very cool. Now, does your husband have like a preference? If he was online and we said, "What's your favorite fermented stored vegetable or things like that?" Does he have a favorite?
Actually, he doesn't eat it at all.
Oh.
He's not a kraut eater. So.
Okay. Well, I love kraut.
I've enjoyed it myself and friends. I feed it to friends and stuff, and they like it so.
Very cool.
Yeah.
Now, have you? And I think you told us earlier you don't do any of the meats and cheeses. Everything you do is the vegetables.
Right. Yeah, I don't have the facilities to do, to do anything with meat or cheese, like making cheese and stuff. I don't have that. I don't have the access to the milk products to do that.
But this potato hole here it looks relatively inexpensive. It wouldn't cost very much for somebody to duplicate that. Is that right?
No, it wouldn't. And we used the concrete round riser just because that's what we had. But you could use, something else and just, I would think, if you had a plastic part of a barrel or, you know, something, even it wouldn't, anything that would work to keep the varmints out of it, basically, is the main thing. And then we just built a frame on the top to put a lid on it, you know. So.
And you were talking about the area you live in humidity. How do you know, is there a simple way to keep the humidity out?
What are you keeping it out of?
Well, like you were saying that, like onions, you don't want as much humidity as you do for say, carrots or, you know.
Okay, we have, basically, Montana doesn't tend to be a real wet place, so we probably have more trouble with getting the humidity up. So the my storing of the onions, for example, would be just what would be in our house, the room, the same humidity that's in our room. And the potatoes seem to do all right in the ground, but we're just not, you know, we probably get 15 inches of rain a year. So it's not what you call very high in humidity here. And so, you know, getting the humidity up is probably more of a problem than keeping it down.
Okay, well,
I know some of you guys get more.
Yeah, and I think most people would think that when I hear Montana, I'm sure my wife would tell me completely differently, but when I hear Montana, for some reason, I would think it's a wet state, being up in the mountains and snow and everything else. But I guess I can see, you know, that there's probably some very dry spots too.
Right. Yeah, I can see the mountains from here, and in the wintertime I can see the snow on the mountains, and we'll have nothing down here. So we've got water around, so we're not, I guess I'm close enough to some lakes that, you know, it's not real, real low in humidity, but there are some areas here, this summer the humidity was down to 10%. It was just, he said, like desert. So, yeah, just in general, it's not a really wet state.
Okay.
Not compared to some places.
All right. Well, Sylvia, we got to get ready to wrap this up. We have to go ahead and jump to our next topic. But we wanted to thank you for coming on. Now, your last article, again, was in issue...
137.
Yeah, issue 37, which was...
137.
Oh, sorry, 137. I knew that. And you can check out all of Sylvia's stuff by going to backwoodshome.com and going ahead and typing in her last name in our writer's directory, and you'll see her issues. She's got an issue, article on brooders in a box and successful cold storage, and one that I wanted to get to today but was kind of off topic, which is making your own nut butters. I've been wanting to try to make nut butters for a while, although I don't know if that's going to be a good thing for me anymore. But
okay, could I mention one thing?
Certainly.
In the last issue of Back Porch View, I have an article on fermenting vegetables.
Ooh.
Okay.
That could maybe jumpstart you on that. And that's at backporchmagazine.com.
Back Porch Magazine. I was just going to ask you if you knew the URL. Back Porch Magazine,
yeah.
And it's the current issue.
Right, yeah. And that's the issues are available on Amazon to download as e-books, I guess.
Oh, that's awesome. That's,
too, so.
That's a good idea, because I think you told me that that magazine is a local magazine, right?
Yeah. I mean, at the point it is. She's only in her second year of publishing, so it's local at this point. But it's got some really good articles for just everybody. So.
Okay, great. All right, so we've been talking to Sylvia Gist. She is a writer for both Backwoods Home Magazine and Back Porch View. And we thank you for joining us, Sylvia. We really appreciate your time.
Well, I have really enjoyed it.
All right, you take
Thanks.
Care.
Thanks. Take care.
Okay, good luck.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
All right. You know, very interesting stuff. You know, she makes it sound so simple.
Yeah.
I don't know if you've ever seen a picture of Sylvia. It's if you go and you pull up her picture, she looks like my kindergarten school teacher. She does. She looks just like you'd picture a school teacher, you know, a school teacher looking, you know, short hair, glasses, you know, white shirt with the big collar. You know, you look at her and you're like, oh yeah, totally a school teacher. And when I was listening to her talk and she's giving you your lessons, I felt like I should be sitting there, you know,
taking
notes and looking forward with both feet on the floor.
Yep.
You know, paying attention. She has that teacher voice.
Yes, she does.
No, but that's wonderful. And good information. I mean, everybody tries to make everything sound so difficult.
Right.
And you know, I really appreciate when you get someone like Sylvia on that just basically said, no, it's simple. We dug a hole in the ground and put a concrete tube in there and threw our potatoes in.
Yeah.
And it's just like, my parents used to dig a hole and you did such and such and you put your potatoes over here and you're, you know, everybody wants to make them sound like a big shot and an expert. And
yeah.
So they take the stuff and just, you know, make it, extrapolate it out so it just seems so cumbersome. When, you know, quite frankly, you know, like she said, when her parents and grandparents were doing it, it wasn't that difficult. It's a hole in the ground, you know, with, you know, something on both sides. You put this over here and this over here and you just, you know, you work through it.
Well, that's why my book is only 30 pages still.
Yeah, no kidding. Well, and I'm very, you know, I don't know if I can convince, you know, my family to do it, because there's like a ton of things I keep saying that we're gonna try and get started on and we never get to it. But I'd like to try that fermenting stuff. I know that I like kraut and I know my wife likes it, and I'm pretty sure most of her family does too. So I don't think the skill would go to waste. And if what she's saying is true, it's really not much more than throwing some salt with some water and making sure it's covered. And
yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it doesn't sound too hard at all, so I think I'm going to check it out. As a matter of fact, I know I am. I'm going to try it before the expo, so that when I get there, if I decide I really like it, there, you know, the equipment is there for sale at the expo. I'll grab it there.
Yeah, she said something interesting that I never really thought of. You know, she said that she had inherited her grandmother's crock,
mm-hmm.
And you know, that's I when I was in Europe. About 10 years ago, you'd walk into places and you would see rows of different crock pots where they were fermenting different things. I mean, making the different types of radishes and things like that. And it never really dawned on me, because crocks are very popular collector's item. You know, those old earthenware crocks that you see. I mean,
yep.
I've wanted one for. I've looked at a couple at auctions, but I wanted to stick my umbrellas and my canes in, you know. But yeah, you know, the original use for a lot of those were doing fermenting and things like that, and it doesn't even dawn on you that they have a practical application as opposed to sticking your nasty shoes or canes in.
That's true. That's true.
That shows you the city boy in me. That, you know, I see a crock and I think about, you know, oh, that'd make a good planter. Or I could stick my canes in there, and you know, here she is, and she's talking about inheriting one, and her first instinct is to go ahead and try fermenting someone and making. So yeah, you know, everybody sees something different.
That's right. That's right. But you know, that's the beauty of that's what makes the world go round. So you know, but I, you know, like you said, I really like how simple she made it. It's super easy. This is something you could do in a Saturday afternoon in no time at all. So,
and I'll tell you what, guys, I would highly recommend you go into backwoodshome.com and looking up her name. The first thing I gravitated to is she had an article that she wrote in 2005, issue 96, called Make Your Own Nut Butters. And once again, her entire article is probably a page and a half. And because she gets right down to the nuts and bolts, it's like, look, you can make it out of almonds, you can make almond butter, cashew butter, raw pecan butter, hazelnut butter, and here's what you have to do, blah, 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 boom, done. And it was just like, wow, that's simple. And, you know, why don't more people do that? Then I went to Google and looked up almond butter, and there must have been a 6-page recipe from this prepper, you know, talking about how to do it. And I'm like, how can she sum it up in 3 paragraphs? and he had to do like multiple pages. Either, yeah. So I don't know. It just it seems a little odd. But anyway, I think that she's really, maybe it's the school teacher in her. Just get to the point, teach the lesson, move on.
That's it. That's what I like. I don't like wasting time. And so, you know, as a lot of people here, I'm sure everybody's time is really valuable. I don't have time to waste reading six pages just because you want to rank higher in Google. You know?
Yeah, that's probably very accurate on what's happening.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So, hey, before we sign off, let's kind of run through. We've got we are almost a week away. I mean, actually, it's less than a week away. When you guys are hearing this is Saturday morning, and our show would be in 6 days. Our setup would be in four. We'd be there setting up 4 days from today.
Stressing me out, man.
I know.
I woke up for the first time in a long time at like 3 o'clock this morning. Stressed out. I had a bad dream that. And I do this at every event, every expo we do. But I woke up in the middle of the night because I was dreaming that nobody was there, and you and I were standing in the aisles talking about it, saying, "Okay, here we are. Nobody's here. All the vendors are staring at us. What do we do?"
Yeah. Well, and you know something? It's an interesting thing. Is I would think, you know, North Carolina, we'd never been there before, and it went incredibly well.
Yeah.
And, you know, here we're in Arizona, never been there before either. And I have to say, the big thing that we, you know, people keep asking for us to do expos. And this is so close to the election that I think everybody's minds are, you know, all over the place. I mean, we're fighting for mind share here. And, you know, I look at that and I'm just kind of like, egads. I'm kind of like you going, you know, what can we possibly do to get people excited? But it's the election that should be driving people. I mean, I watched the debate last night and, you know, you're listening to both these guys talk and I'm looking at it and I'm going, hell, we're losers either way. Yeah. I don't see either, you know, I don't have a good feeling that either side has a good grasp on how to dig us out of this hole.
Have you read that book Aftershock yet?
I have not, and I know the gentleman is speaking at our event.
He is. Basically, to sum it up, and I hate to even say that and use those terms because it's so much information. It's a really good book, but. The thing is what he tries to explain is it's too late. The missile has already been launched. You cannot stop it. And so either way, these guys are trying to fix the economy and fix things and make it better, but it's to the point of no return is what he's saying.
See, and that scares the bejesus out of me. I don't want to take away from this gentleman because I'm actually looking right now because I'm not like you. I typically buy a book and like to read it, but since I've got theoretically a 23 to 26 hour drive ahead of me, I might actually see if this thing's on audio.
Oh yeah, it is. It is. I bought the audio version because I listened to it on the way to our Dallas event when I drove down there.
And okay, well I'm not finding it yet, but I might have to look someplace other than iTunes. But anyway, I watched a movie called Atlas Shrugs.
Oh yeah, I read that book too.
Have you?
Okay. Yeah, that's a really thick book. That's honestly, hands down, that's probably one of my top three books of choice. When people ask me books to read, that's one of the top three.
Really?
Yep.
Now, this is a book that was written in the 50s.
Yeah.
And let me tell you, if you've never read Ayn Rand, and she was also the writer of Fountainhead.
Yep.
And that was a book, Fountainhead, you had to read in school. I never read Atlas Shrugs, though. I'm definitely going to get it now after seeing the movie. the predictions that they have in that book written in the 50s is, I mean, you could almost take a checklist to this darn book.
Yep.
And just go, it talks about, the economy falling, in the book, like 80% of people are out of work, the economy's, and so the government's pushing all these regulations. Like one of the regulations they pass is they say that there's too many people that are wealthy and have multiple interests, and so they pass a law that no person can own more than one company.
Yeah.
And so all these people are signing their companies over to the government.
Have you watched part two? Part two is out now.
No. I just actually what happened, I think I mean, this is horrible, but I was not feeling well the other day, and I was laying down, and there's a bug that's kind of going around, a stomach bug, and my daughter's had it, and I ended up getting it. And I hit Netflix, and the new movie's coming out, so whenever the new movie comes out, Netflix finally gets the old one. That's kind of how Netflix works. They don't get anything new. Yeah, you get so season 12 going on, and you get season 4 on Netflix.
Exactly.
One of the things that popped up was Atlas Shrugged, and I said, I've heard so many things about this movie. It was a low budget movie, but I heard it was really, really good. So I'm going to go ahead and click and watch it. And I started watching this thing, and next thing I know, it was like I was hooked. It was like, wow, this is just an amazing movie for a low budget movie, and felt so much like it was written for 2012.
Yeah, I know. And I know. It's amazing. It's amazing. And part two is even, continues on with the book. There's actually going to be a part three. The book is really long. I mean, the audio version unabridged, I think, is like 60 some odd hours. It's a big book.
Wow. That's pretty incredible. So yeah, anyway, I'm going to do that. But anyway, going back it's David Widmer, right?
David Widmer. Yeah.
Widmer.
Or I'm sorry. It's.
Yeah, that's something, right?
No, it's not David. It's Bob. It's Bob Widmer. He's got a brother. I think his name's David, but his name is Robert Widmer.
Okay, his name's Robert. Okay.
So Bob, Bob Widmer, and his book. That was the other one I was going to, when you mentioned Atlas Shrugged, when you said it was like it was written for today, that's how I felt about Aftershock. It's like the stuff that he wrote about in 2009, you got to remember, he wrote it in 2009 saying this is going to happen between now and 2015. And you start reading that book and you're like, holy crap, this stuff is happening. He's dead on. It's exactly what's going to happen. And it's just amazing.
Now, Robert Widmer what's his background? So for people who haven't figured it out yet, he's actually going to be our keynote speaker on Saturday, the 27th, mm-hmm. At the show.
Yep.
Now I somebody said that he's a financial guy, right?
Yep. That's what he does. And what I like about him is he goes, look, I don't care about the right, the left. I don't. He goes, I have no interest in that. He goes, I'm a number cruncher. And numbers don't lie. So he goes, I strictly just look at the numbers. And he goes, I can predict everything that's going to happen just by looking at the numbers and studying those. And he wrote a book in 2006. And when he wrote the book in 2006, it was about what's going to happen between 2006 and 2010. And it was dead on. He talked about 2008 and what was going to happen then and all that stuff. And 2000, the book he wrote, the second version that he wrote in 2009, the second edition, is saying that this could happen between now and 2015. Obviously, there's a bunch of things that could happen that will delay it or speed it up. And right now, it's being sped up. The things that he's talked about in his book that say this shouldn't happen until 2013, 2014 have already happened.
Really?
Yeah.
That's pretty scary.
Yeah.
Well, it goes back to, what I was saying, which is, it seems like with the election right around the corner and the way things are just going in general in the world, that it would be driving droves and droves and droves of pizza people.
Pizza.
Wow. Did that Freudian slip, that hunger thing. I was just looking. It's funny. I was sitting here looking at my cup of tea thinking, man, I'm really hungry. Panda Pizza would think, and that's when it's going on in my head while I'm talking, and then pizza slipped out. So it goes to show you that shouldn't be thinking about food or pizza while you're talking about a well-known author. Anyway, that people wouldn't be more concerned. I'm personally finding that the closer we get to the election, the more people, they just seem to be sitting back on their hindquarters and just waiting to see what happens. And it reminds me of, the idiots that, and if you're one of these idiots, I apologize that you are, that sits around when somebody says that there's a storm coming in, Hurricane Katrina is coming in, and I'm going to wait to see how bad it gets before I go and get my supplies, or I'm going to leave. And
yeah.
Those are always the people you have to rescue.
Yeah.
Right? It's the ones that the bridge washes out, and they're sitting on top of the roof of their building waving their arms, and when the people are saying, well, why didn't you leave? I didn't know it was going to be this bad. Well, everybody else did. The other 100,000 people evacuated.
Right.
And that's kind of how I feel it's going with people, which is everybody's going, I'm going to wait to see how bad the storm gets. And then when the storm happens, it's musical chairs where there's only one seat, but everybody thinks there's more. And then when the music stops, everybody realizes there's only going to be one person sitting. And everybody else is out of luck.
Yep, exactly.
So, like I said, it worries me. I'll listen to Aftershock as I go, and then I'll call my wife and tell her she needs to read it, and she'll say, I don't need to be scared anymore, forget it. And then I'll sit in the house and be paranoid enough for the both of us.
It is scary. But what's nice about it is he doesn't he also gives you solutions. That's what I like about it. He's like, this is what's going to happen, but this is how you fix it. Or this is how you prepare for it. I mean, you can't fix the economy, but you can prepare for it. And this is how you can come out on top.
Well, that's good. I mean, that's a good start. I feel that in 2 weeks, and the scary part is when we come back, we're only going to be like 5 days until the election.
Right.
By the time I drive back, we'll have Halloween, and then a few days later, we'll know what's going to be happening with the world. And, I feel like I want to crawl in my cubby hole for those days and just come out when it's all over and say, okay, well, who won?
Who won and what do I need to fix?
Yeah, exactly. What do I need to do now? All right. Well, enough talk about that. So anyway, we have he's going to be our keynote speaker. We have Lisa Bedford, Survivor Mom, that will be at the show, and she'll be speaking on Saturday. And we have all kinds of people. We have Mark Price. We have Dr. Bones Nurse Amy, Anna Francis. We have Jared Winger, right?
Yep.
From doTERRA.
Uh-huh.
We'll be there.
Doterra. Yep.
Connie Nielsen from Life Sprouts, although she hasn't contacted me back yet. And I think we need to talk to her about getting her darn email fixed, because it's just... I get more emails that bounce from that woman than any other company. He's not speaking. I was going to talk to you about this. He's doing a hands-on class.
Oh, I thought he was going to do both.
I need you to verify that for me before Friday, because the only thing they sent to us was a thing that says that they need tables and chairs and things, because they're actually going to teach this hands-on class, which is free. So, guys,
it's my understanding it was above and beyond, but I'll confirm.
Okay, and if that's the case, then we'll get him a speaking slot too. But guys, Dr. Christopher from the School of Natural Healing never does a hands-on class for free, and if you can make it down there to come out and check out this hands-on class, this is going to be phenomenal. But on top of that, Homestead General and their sister school are going to be doing a bunch of different classes at the event.
Yep.
And that's going to be pretty cool. I mean,
They're doing cheese making and soap making and all kinds of cool stuff we got going on. We got the suturing classes. We'll have, Dr. Christopher's School of Natural Healing is going to be doing a, what do you call that? When they, extract the herb.
Extraction?
Dang it. Oh, man. I am not this bad. I really am not. It's, here it is. Here it is. Here's the class description. I'm going to go ahead and read it, just since we got it. This is a hands-on class. We'll teach the participants how to take simple herb and common materials from your home or backyard and make them into a medicinal preparation. It's called what is it called? You will make simple preparations and take home that will remedy the most basic and common ailments, as well as first aid and emergency care. The class will cover extracts, poultices, throat remedies, and nasal blockages, and more.
That's
kind of cool.
Yeah, a poultice is what, you know, like a mixture of herbs that you put on wounds and or things like that.
Very cool. Very cool. Yeah, tincture. Isn't that what it's called? Tincture. I think it's called tincture.
It may be. I have no idea.
I think it's called tincture.
It'll
be cool. That class is cool.
I will admit my ignorance on this one. I don't know. So I'm going to throw something out there. Since this will air on Saturday, and I'll either be able to confirm or deny it on Facebook afterwards, but I might as well go ahead and throw it out here. And I don't know who posted this, but it plays right into it. And I actually haven't asked Colorado Ron, but I'm assuming he's going to let me do it anyway. I may speak at the event. I saved a space for myself, and if not, I have someone that'll fill it. But I'm going to meet a gentleman named Jim Kempf. And Jim Kempf is the founder, CEO, and the creator of a reverse technology for crossbows. And he's the inventor of the Scorpid crossbow. And, you know, I've been looking at things, and I was the article, the talk I wanted to give was on modern primitive weapons in uses in current prepping situations.
Modern primitive weapons.
Right. Meaning that, you know, primitive weapons are knives, spears, you know, all those different things, bows. And, you know, people shy away from them because they're very difficult to master, and they're not very efficient. But in a pinch, they're the most utilitarian, right? Because it's like when you're talking about a gun, from operational security standpoint, you know, guns aren't very effective because they're not silent, unless you have a silencer on them. The maintenance of them is very high, and you have to have rounds in order to make them, you know, work.
Right.
And so in a scenario where, you know, you would want to conserve it and use a weapon like a gun more for physical security than hunting, you know, if we were to have riots, or we were to have, you know, whatever it is, you know, sound discipline is very, very important. And to utilize a bullet to take an animal down is not the best use for a bullet. A bullet is better used for defense of your family or your homestead, because once you shoot that, the noise is very loud, and so you're giving away things, and it'll be more effective stopping someone permanently than it is to take down a squirrel or a rabbit or a turkey or something like that. So, yeah, I was looking at, and so I'm very big in here with our family. Most of my family, you know, everybody here shoots a compound bow. You know, we all believe in semi-primitive weapons to go deer hunting and things like that. It's efficient. You know, it's reusable. Your arrows and your tips and everything else are reusable until you break them, but they're very inexpensive to have them, very low maintenance. It's not like oiling a gun and things like that. But the problem is your average child, teenager, or housewife, and even a lot of men, couldn't necessarily be able to fire a bow accurately. It takes a lot of practice and everything else. But modern crossbows are very light. They can shoot. Some of these things shoot accurately up to 100 yards.
And you'd be able to use the arrow over and over, right?
Exactly. You know, and so in a scenario where you're talking about hunting, you know, being able to take a crossbow with a scope on it and take out a squirrel or a rabbit from 40 or 50 yards accurately and not make any noise, drop it in your bag, and then pull the arrow out and keep going and hunt again is a much more effective. I think that the crossbow is the modern prepper's best friend.
And if anybody needs unlimited ammo, it would be Bubba.
That's right. That's definitely right. And so anyway, I'm gonna drive tomorrow and meet the founder of this, and I'm gonna try to convince him to let me bring some of these. His technology is state of the art, and actually, he's a little guy. You know, he works out of his garage, but his technology is so popular that all the big companies are trying to buy his technology while the patent is pending. And so almost every crossbow and bow company right now is going to be using his technology in this next year. They all have announced bows using his reverse technology.
Is there a way to get our hands on one?
I'm going to hopefully bring three to the event.
And you're not planning on taking all three back, are you?
Oh, unfortunately, yeah. They're all prototypes, so I have to bring them
back. Dang it.
I'm hopefully tomorrow I'm going to discuss with him bringing some of them out, showing them to people, and having up a little range out there so people can see how easy it is to cock it and fire it. And this bow has been tested. There's a couple videos out there. There's this one, another one, both using the reverse technology, that they put three arrows in a 3-inch circle at 100 yards. That's a football field away. And that's amazing.
That's
a bullet shot.
Wow.
And so as a modern weapon. So if I can get this, I think that, you know, I think this is going to be a new phenomenon for people in that are prepping, because, you know, anybody can do this. Anybody can go out and hunt with something like this. It's like holding a rifle because you're actually holding it up. Again, old crossbows 10 years ago, the big thing was it was just like a compound bow. You had to have the strength to pull back that 100-pound pull or more to be able to lock it and cock it. Now, my daughter could do it. It's two strings, and you pull up, and you stand up, and the tension brings back and cocks it. And then that thing has enough 450 feet per second.
Wow.
Yeah, they're amazing devices, and hopefully I'll be able to bring one out. So if you guys – and the Scorpid crossbow, he was joking with me when I was talking to him. He was telling me that when he first came up with this reverse technology, it got used in we were talking about this. It's funny because you kind of brought it up to me the other day on accident. It's the crossbow that's being used in that zombie movie, the zombie TV show,
Walking Dead.
Walking Dead. The guy carries a Scorpid. And everybody thinks it looks like something out of Blade Runner or Road Warrior, because it's such a futuristic looking crossbow. And you know, so hey guys, not only is it good for hunting, but it also is really good for zombie apocalypse attacks. So for all these zombie guys out there. Anyway, so that's what he uses out there, and they're always showing him cock and pull the trigger and pulling out squirrels and things like that, and he pulls it down from the tree and then grabs it and keeps going. And it's so silent. I mean, you would not know that you're shooting it. And I was watching a video of someone taking out like two deer, one right after the other, because it was so silent. The first deer didn't even hear the arrow go through, and it did a pass through. And he was able to cock it, take a second shot, and take down the second deer.
Dang.
Yeah, at like 50 yards. Very cool.
That's cool.
Yeah, anyway, so hopefully tomorrow he'll agree to let me take the three prototypes that he's been taking to the shows out with me. He sounds like he was going to do it. And then if people are interested, maybe next year we'll actually have him set up a booth. But I thought it would be very cool for people to see these things and check it out.
Heck yeah.
So, all right. Well, that's it. We did it. We're out of time again. Once again, we managed to BS for a full amount of time. Did you have anything else, Colorado?
I do not. I'm good.
All right. So, guys, this has been Backwoods Home Magazine, Self-Reliance Exposed with Bubba DaVinci and Colorado Ron. And as always, you can get our information websites, www.backwoodshome.com. You can check out our current expo at www.selfrelianceexpo.com. Facebook pages, Colorado Ron, yours is?
It's / Colorado Ron page.
Colorado Ron page. Please make sure you put that page in there. It won't go anywhere if you don't. Backwoods Home Magazine is Backwoods Home Mag. Preparedness Radio. We have Self-Reliance Expo and Bubba Da Vinci. Any of those will hit you our pages. We appreciate you joining us this week. Next week, we will be at the expo. It will be a best of, and when we come back the following week, we'll have highlights from the Self-Reliance Expo. So thank you guys for joining us, and we'll talk to you guys soon. Take care.
Take care.
You've been listening to BHM Radio, the official show for Backwoods Home Magazine on the Preparedness Radio Network. Tune in every other week at this time to get more information on the articles you love. Questions or comments for the hosts? Email them at coloradoron@gmail.com. Until next time, remember, preparedness saves lives.
No power? No problem. Whether you're living totally off the grid or just preparing for a winter storm, at Lehman's, we've got you covered. Glenda Lehman Irvin here for Lehman's in Kidron, Ohio. My father, Jay Lehman, founded our store in 1955 to serve the local Amish with non-electric appliances, tools, and houseware. Today, through our website, laymans.com, a print catalog, and a retail store, we provide oil lamps, water pumps, wood stoves, canning supplies, and hand tools to customers all over the world. So, whether you want to save money on your heating bills with a wood-burning stove, feed healthy, homegrown food to your family by gardening and preserving, or simply be kind to the earth by drying your clothes on a clothesline, Layman's is your source. Visit laymans.com or call us at 1-877-438-5436 for a catalog, or just stop by our store in Kidron, Ohio.
Hey, old Dr. Bones here. Are you prepared to deal with medical issues in a disaster situation? What would you do if medical help was not on the way? The Doom and Bloom Survival Medicine Handbook is over 400 pages of how-to advice written in plain English. You'll learn to handle all the likely medical issues you'll encounter in times of trouble. And it's not just the conventional medical wisdom. We talk about alternatives like essential oils, medicinal herbs, and other home remedies. Make the Doom and Bloom Survival Medicine Handbook a part of your survival library. And don't forget, Nurse Amy and I have medical kits, suture materials, instructional DVDs, and other items that'll help you keep it together even if things fall apart. Check them out, as well as 200 articles on medical preparedness, survival gardening, and other alternative remedies on our website at www.doomandbloom.net. Never think doom and gloom, think doom and bloom.
Did you know that several major European countries are at risk of defaulting on their financial obligations? The U.S. economy will suffer substantially if this happens. Inflation is getting worse, and with a European default, hyperinflation is very possible. If hyperinflation occurs, store shelves will be empty within days and food prices will skyrocket. Will you be able to feed your family when hyperinflation hits? BuyEmergencyFoods.com offers the best kind of emergency food, Legacy Premium, with the largest variety available in the freeze-dried food industry. Each meal is packaged for freshness in individual nitrogen-flushed Mylar pouches. The meal pouches are then sealed in stackable heavy-duty plastic containers that are easy to store, easy to transport, and won't be damaged by water or rodents. So, if you're worried about food inflation, economic crisis, unemployment, or natural disasters, then don't delay and prepare your family now. Buy your emergency food supply today. Disasters happen. Don't get fooled into thinking that they can't happen to you. Order today and use the promo code E2E and get free shipping and 5% off on every item. Survival is not about the end of the world. It's not about a hypothetical plane crash or the latest violent storm. Survival is about the satisfaction of knowing you can take care of yourself and your family in any situation, anytime, anywhere. CampingSurvival.com was started in 1956. No, not the .com part, the survival part. CampingSurvival.com has over 17,000 urban, wilderness, and preparedness items, supreme customer service, very low shipping, and no games. We look around to make sure we have the lowest prices. And CampingSurvival.com is 100% USMC veteran-owned. Don't base your survival on the latest spring-up-on-the-internet company. Do business with an authority on survival. CampingSurvival.com. Confidence born on preparation. Order today and use the promo code E2E for an additional 5% off your order. You've been listening to the Preparedness Radio Network, offering helpful and timely tips on preparing for natural and man-made disasters. Timely and useful tips on gardening and homesteading. Check us out online at BePreparedRadio.com. Until next time, remember, preparedness saves lives. This is the Preparedness Radio Network.